You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, from Ukraine to the Harvard and Oxbridge campuses, Ben, Judah and Samira Shackle will be here to go through today's biggest stories. And a little later in the show, we'll explore the history of America's first subway system. It all started, apparently, in a sibling rivalry. Also ahead, we'll look at what's making the headlines in Norway, and we'll review the best of London ballet. All coming up here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty ahead then in the next hour here on the programme. Before we get started, let's hear from Bill Bingham, who has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. Pro-Russian activists have stormed Ukraine's naval base in the Crimean city of Sevastopol. Russian flags are now flying from the building, and Ukrainian servicemen have been seen leaving it. There are unconfirmed reports that the head of Ukraine's navy has been detained. On Tuesday, President Vladimir Putin signed a treaty formally making Crimea part of the Russian Federation, but insisted he had no ambitions for the rest of Ukraine. The United States and Europe are warning Russia its annexation of Crimea could harm its relations around the world for years to come. Russia appears to have been blocking moves to send international monitors to investigate the crisis. Daniel Bayer, the American ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, says Russian delegates are prevaricating.
This is the third time that a text has been presented to which only one state objects, and that's the Russian Federation. Meanwhile, they continue to say that they understand the urgency of deploying monitors, that they support it, and so they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. Foreign Minister Lavrov has personally engaged on this text, has offered edits numerous times, and each time they are accepted, he comes back with more, or his delegation comes back with more. Moreover, today, they can't even say exactly what they want.
Two women thought to be related to Chinese passengers on the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 have been removed from a press conference in Kuala Lumpur. Police have stopped the media from speaking to them. The authorities say they've received new radar data but are not yet in a position to make the details public. 26 countries are still involved in the search for the plane, which went missing 11 days ago with 239 people on board. The South African human rights lawyer says President Jacob Zuma has benefited unduly from using state money to make improvements to his rural residence. The changes to Mr. Zuma's private home, including a pool and cattle enclosure, cost taxpayers about $23 million. In a 400-page report, public protector Thuli Madonsela has accused Mr. Zuma of unethical conduct. She says Mr. Zuma, who faces re-election in May, should repay costs for some of the unnecessary renovations. British detectives investigating the 2007 disappearance of Madeleine McCann say they're looking for a man suspected of carrying out a series of assaults on young girls staying in Portuguese holiday villas between 2004 and 2010. Madeleine, who was three at the time, went missing from her bedroom at the Praia da Luz holiday resort in the Algarve while her parents were dining with friends at a nearby restaurant. Andy Redwood, senior investigating officer at London's Metropolitan Police Service, says he's still working under the assumption that Madeleine is still alive.
Madeleine McCann's disappearance is a huge challenge to us. And what I've not been able to prove is that she's not alive. And so as far as I am concerned, even if the prospect of her alive is just 0.1% chance, then I maintain that there is a possibility she's alive. And as a result of that, we will continue to pursue this case.
Venezuela's government has announced that it's breaking commercial ties with Air Canada a day after the airline suspended flights to Caracas, citing the country's civil unrest. At least 29 people have been killed during about 6 weeks of protests and violent clashes between demonstrators and the security forces. Air Canada says it could no longer ensure the safety of its operations. The French rogue trader who caused huge losses at the Société Générale Bank has lost his appeal against a three-year jail sentence. The Cour de Cassation, France's highest court, upheld the jail sentence against Jérôme Kerviel, but ordered a review of the 4.9 billion euros in damages he was told to pay. The court said a lower court decision had not taken into account the bank's own responsibility when it ordered him to make good the bank's entire losses. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. And there'll be more news, of course, from Bill Bingham at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se che che che.
From London,
London, London,
cara.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 6 minutes past 1800 hours, 1406 in New York City. Well, joining me now to look at the biggest news stories of the day, and one or two you maybe haven't cast your eye over just yet, are Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin, and the journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always. Today's news agenda continues to be dominated by Ukraine since Russia's official annexation of Crimea yesterday and the seizing of the Sevastopol military base by pro-Russian forces. Ukraine's Security Council chief has just announced the country will remove its military from the peninsula and return them to the mainland. Of course, this is a test for the West and perhaps an occasion for NATO to rise again as something of a counterweight to Russia. Ben, let me come to you first. You're just back from Kiev.
Yes.
Tell me about the sort of, I guess, the atmosphere in the country. People have talked about it transferring from an explicitly political crisis to a military one. Is that the sense that you got on the ground?
But the sense when you're in Kiev, have you ever asked your parents or grandparents what it was like to live through the Cuban Missile Crisis? And people always tell the same story, which is that at one point during those 8 days, they looked at their baby or they looked at the sun and asked themselves if they would live to see the next week. And that's the atmosphere in Kiev right now. People are having breakdowns, people are frightened, people are unable to sleep because Kiev is living in the shadow of war. And people are completely unsure whether or not Putin will stop in Crimea. Why should they trust him when he said that he had no designs on Crimea? They're completely unsure if he'll stop at the east or if he'd come all the way to Kiev. People are having nightmares about invading Russian troops. In the centre of Kiev, the Maidan protest tents, which were several months ago the site of happy-clappy Facebook activists, are now occupied by far-right militias. And these far-right militias are outside the National Parliament banging drums and setting off smoke bombs and setting alight tyres, demanding that something be done. So there's an atmosphere of chaos and fear.
A pretty alarming picture. I'll ask you a little more about some of those details in a moment or two. Samira, if I just come to you there, first of all, in terms of that sense that, Ben raises there about, where will this stop? Are we wrong to sort of reassure ourselves that this is just a single event and there's not any question of any sort of, dominoes tumbling? Do you think that it's incorrect to make that assumption? Is there any way you can conclude maybe what the limits or reaches of Putin's ambitions in this respect might be?
I think it's really difficult to say where it's going to end. It's sort of... The consensus seems to be that that Crimea is certainly not the be-all and end-all, that it seems that over the last sort of at least 5 years since the territories were taken from Georgia in 2008, that I think that the sort of Russian-speaking minorities have been a way for Putin to sort of cement power, I think. And so there's a question, I think there's certainly... It seems evident that the Russian establishment wants some kind of influence over Ukraine, whether that takes the form of further territorial incursions or whether that takes the form of seeking to influence the government in Kiev that ultimately is in Kiev, I think remains to be seen.
Absolutely, it's very difficult to chart it. Ben, in terms of the right-wing elements that you mentioned...
But let me just quickly say that what's happening is Putin has a gun to the head of the Ukrainian army, and that gun is an army of 100,000 people in the north of Ukraine, just over the border in the north of Ukraine, just over the border in the east of Ukraine, and then the forces of a similar size in Crimea. And what Putin has presented is a leaked document, which is his demands. And the demands are that Ukraine have permanent neutrality It never joined the EU. It never joined NATO. Mm. This neutrality is guaranteed by the EU, Russia and the US. And that Ukraine then be federalized. And Putin's inspiration, perhaps the only time this inspiration has ever been for a politician, is Bosnia. And Bosnia is composed of two federal units, a Bosnian Serb unit and a Bosniak and Croatian unit, with basically an empty shell of a central government. So this is Putin's vision. And this would allow him to basically have the south and east of Ukraine anyway, because the Party of Regions, his client party, could rule over it, but with the benefit that he could sort of come back and fight another day and take back Kiev and Lviv if the date presents it. Also in this demand is to recognise the fait accompli of the annexation of Crimea to the Russian Federation. Could the West agree to chunks of this? You know, we're living in a really tragic era for Western power when William Hague can be considered a man like well-briefed in foreign affairs. And it wouldn't surprise me in the era of the Hollande government that the West could compromise on elements of that. But the question is, could the Ukrainian government? The Ukrainian government, in my opinion, could never agree to that.
Well, tell me then, what does the West do then? You're painting this picture. It's incredibly alarming. Where do we look? What institutions do we look to? Do we look to NATO? There's questions about the effectiveness. You know, is this a redundant institution? Where do you think we should look? I mean, Samira, what do you think about NATO in particular? Coming in for, it's certainly in the spotlight now. Do they offer a solution, a remedy to the kind of situation that Ben's describing?
It is certainly in the spotlight. I think there's something slightly odd about the slightly gleeful talk about, is this going to give a new purpose for NATO? It seems quite peculiar for something that's a sort of essentially a military body. I think that there's certainly a big question mark about what NATO can or should do, given that William Hague has ruled out military action. And I think that it is a moment of sort of reconsidering that relationship between the West and Russia. But I think while so much of this is reminiscent of the Cold War, there's a fundamental difference in the fact that we live in a globalised economy. That's a profoundly different context in which we're operating. And I think actually one thing that's really interesting is how much this has underscored the importance of the US to European security, that the EU, much as it's sort of working towards being a coherent political and a sort of foreign policy force, still very much looks to America.
Should we look then to economic solutions? Is that meaningless?
But what this was, this wasn't a blitzkrieg, this was a blinkkrieg. For a moment, there was a kind of days of joy. Putin had been driven out of Ukraine. He wasn't going to get his kind of tripartite summit to decide the fate of these Ukrainian peasants with the Americans. And then, blink, he's back in the room and he's taken Crimea. And what if at that moment, bam, we take out your banks, we take out your brokering companies, we take out your oligarchs' fortunes in Knightsbridge, you're never coming back to Mayfair, this would have stopped him. But what did they do instead? They visa banned 21 people. Mm-hmm. Like, Russia just became the first country, the first major power since the 1930s in Europe to embark on the politics of annexation. And they visa banned 21 people. And in the Russian press, this has been touted as a triumph, and we have nothing to fear. They'll put their relationships with our banks and our oil and gas before anything else. And even the people on the list have been bragging about it and how it's an honour. And
so where does that failure then lie? Would you put that squarely at the door of Britain, Western politicians, Britain specifically?
Britain, because we know what the British elite is. The British elite is an elite of butlers. It's an elite of lawyers, management consultants, hedge funders. It's an elite of PR artists. Where's their money come from? Their money comes from taking oligarch rent. It comes from picking the pockets of sheikhs that come from the Middle East, and of picking the pockets of oligarchs that come in from Russia. And this class will never kill the oligarch golden goose that feeds them. You know, we live in a Britain today where Morgan Stanley rented out Buckingham Palace, had a party. You know, how does Morgan Stanley make his money? Morgan Stanley makes his money by what they euphemistically call emerging markets. What are emerging markets? Emerging markets are authoritarian states.
Well, what if we look to, you know, the big power brokers in Europe, to Germany then? The same concerns, perhaps? Or is there a different agenda, do you think, dominating Frau Merkel's thoughts?
Well, Britain is the hub of the oligarch fortune. The Russian elite, for every ruble it steals, it puts 99 kopecks of that ruble in Britain and Britain's empire of tax havens over which the sun never sets. If Britain alone could destroy the Putin regime by severing those fortunes. You know, Germany has a different kind of relationship with Russia. It's a far more classic economic relationship of kind of factories and trade and export. And in this crisis, what we've really seen is that David Cameron's Britain is utterly irrelevant in European politics. You know, the first power that America chooses to talk to are the Germans. Guess the number second are the French. The number third are the Poles. You know, David Cameron was allowed to speak to Putin. And I say allowed because Putin wasn't interested in speaking to him for more than an hour once, not taking calls from this guy. Person who's spoken to for 9 hours over the past weeks, Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel was, of course, the spokeswoman of the GDR in its final days and speaks to Putin in impeccable Russian because she won awards from the Soviet occupation forces for her fluency in Russian. And she is deeply alarmed by this. She gave a speech to the Bundestag readying Germany for economic war, saying we have to be ready to stop this man that lives by the laws of the jungle to hurt our factories.
A black and white picture there painted, pretty damning in terms of Britain's role or non-role in this. Do you go along with that, Samira?
I think that there's always been an issue about elites in Britain perhaps being concerned with vested interests. That's true if you look to the Middle East, perhaps, and inconsistencies in how our sort of commitment to human rights are enforced there in, say, Saudi Arabia versus Libya, for instance. But I would sort of hesitate to take such a black and white view, actually, because I think that, first of all, Britain's foreign policy doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, that there's sort of concerns like NATO, like the EU, like all the things we've been talking about that's there. And I think also you can't deny the fact that Europe is quite reliant on Russian oil and gas. And I think that while that is an unfortunate fact, and were I ruler of the world or even Europe, I would like to think I wouldn't make foreign policy based on oil and gas.
Yeah. But that's not true, because if you've got Russia can't sell that oil and that gas to anybody else. So if Russia turned off its gas, Russia go bankrupt.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be Britain operating in a vacuum, would it? That would require consensus from lots of different European countries.
Russia's not even capable of putting oil and gas sanctions. Russia isn't capable of responding in any kind of meaningful way that could destroy the electricity of the European Union.
It is an interesting point that Samira makes about the sort of coherent response that you'd need from the EU. It's interesting they've got their spring summit. They probably didn't anticipate the agenda would be shaped exactly the way it's going to be. How do you think we can expect them to react, perhaps, when they meet, you know, in Brussels? You've got foreign ministers talking together. Is there any way they can find some common ground? Can they create that shared voice? Or do you think it's an impossibility politically?
I think you can sort of see that different states' responses are quite dictated by their proximity to Russia to an extent. And I think also it's not solely economic, I'd say. There's also that given the globalised political and economic context that we live in, I would say the political thing is quite important for countries like Britain or America. It's not just about, like, if you put the issue of gas completely to one side, there's, for instance, like cooperation on the Syria crisis, all sorts of other political
what
things.
What cooperation
which don't want
on
to
the
be.
Syria crisis? What there's, have they done?
I'm not like the voice of NATO, Ben.
What cooperation is there to lose in Russia and Syria?
The hopes of a diplomatic solution, for right or wrong, whether that's successful or not, it's clearly not successful, but that is what the US and Britain have committed to. And to deliberately sever ties with Russia would be to end that commitment to a diplomatic solution, which is a commitment that they've made.
Let's return into Ukraine itself. I mean, it's intriguing to sort of look at the reaction of people, you know, within Crimea. You mentioned the comparisons with Georgia, the scenes we saw there before. How misguided, Ben, do you feel that people who are, you know, within these areas celebrating the arrival are? How short-sighted is that? Are there so many lessons of history that, in your view, that perhaps they're not learning?
But one thing I've learned as a journalist from reporting in the Middle East, in Russia, in all over Europe, in South America, is it's very easy to brainwash people. It's extremely easy. You control their TV, you beam stuff out, you play the right music, their emotions lift up. It's not hard. It would be very easy to do that with British people. You know, if the lesson of history is anything, it's that, is that Europeans today are as vulnerable as they were to nationalist hysteria, you know, in Serbia in the 1990s or in, you know, in Austria celebrating its Anschluss in the 1930s.
That's a pretty grim picture. Do you really think that they are as susceptible? We're not slightly more savvy and more canny as a collective? You feel that definitely the case that it's the same susceptibility is there, perhaps?
Yes.
Unequivocally so. Do you share that view, or do you think people are better informed? We've surely learned some of the lessons, haven't we?
I don't think that everything's down to brainwashing. I think probably most populations are equally susceptible to brainwashing, but I think that depending on the topic you're being brainwashed about, it's impossible to divorce it from context. So I think you can, I don't think you can talk about one population susceptibility versus another. I think it's quite issue dependent, and certainly in the case of Crimea, for instance, I think it's very dependent on the fact that it's had this sort of long and complicated history of hundreds of years being part of Russia, and I think that sort of context provides a place for that to take place.
Absolutely. Well, let's just sort of gaze into our crystal ball then, trying to answer, I guess, some of these sort of unanswerable questions in some respects about, you know, where this goes from here, the domino effect and so on. Various sort of, it's pretty frightening language of that character. Ben, what do you think, though, we're looking at with this? Is this, you know, stage one in this sort of operation from Putin and Russia, or do you think, you know, it is a special case? Can we trust what he says? Where would you sort of hedge your bets? And
well, firstly, estimate? You can't trust anything this man says. You know, Putin said a week ago that he had no designs on Crimea and there were no Russian troops in Crimea, and today Crimea is part of the Russian
Federation. So do we prepare for this to happen simply again and again?
What Putin has done is he's discovered a form of political crack, which is that his popularity was going down. Invade, grab a piece where ethnic Russians are, your popularity jumps up again. He's not even that unpopular at the moment. What's to stop him when the economy really gets into trouble and the economy is going to go into recession next quarter from, you know, having Belarus? What's to stop him? Well, it's certainly not any banking sanctions. What's to stop him with taking northern Kazakhstan, which is ethnic Russian, if he feels the need? No, there's no serious Russian sanctions from the West.
That's a bleak picture. Samira, again, in your crystal ball, does it have the same gloomy aspect? Or do you think that we might see, you know, should the situation continue to worsen and spiral downwards, that would finally galvanise these kind of disparate interests that we've been talking about?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it looks good either. And I think it's really difficult to say where it's going to stop. I don't think this is the end. I don't think Crimea is the be all and end all, as Ben says. Putin was saying that he didn't have designs on Crimea. So I think we sort of have to wait and see. I don't think it's good, and I don't hold out that much hope for the Western response becoming more decisive soon. Because I think that there's a lot of sort of hand wringing about this idea of. That there is this sort of affront at the idea, at the notion of Russia annexing another country, but there is this sort of hand wringing about the idea of self determination and the specifics of the Crimea situation sort of being used as a way to, you know, well, they voted in the referendum. Do you know what I mean? Even if the referendum has been called illegitimate.
We'll continue the discussions with both Samira Shackle, from whom we're hearing there, and with Ben Judah on Midori House right after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and still with me are Ben Judah and Samira Shackle. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the Middle East. Samira, we actually alluded to Syria and the possible sort of ripples that could extend from Russia and the West and their struggles to see eye to eye, and how that could affect the Syria conflict. Israel says it's attacked several Syrian military sites in the last couple of days in retaliation for a bombing that wounded its troops in occupied Golan Heights, blaming Bashar al-Assad's government, not the rebels or Hezbollah, interestingly, which is, of course, one of the groups that supports Damascus. What do you think about this? If it is retaliation, is that something to worry about, that Israel is getting further involved here? Does that threaten even greater instability to that which we already see? What's your take?
I think that... Israel has been profoundly concerned about the crisis in Syria spilling over into its borders since the crisis began, pretty much. And that's why Israel was one of the staunchest supporters for Western military action when that was on the table. I don't think we're going to see necessarily a big escalation, but I think this is a sort of warning sign, because that this is actually the third incident in the last week or so, I think, in that sort of border region with Syria in Golan Heights. And previous incidents, they've thought, well, maybe it's an accident. And this is a sort of a warning, I think. So I don't think there's a desire, particularly from Damascus or from Tel Aviv, to see this escalate into a full-blown war. The Syrian military, interestingly, in their statement, was sort of warning Israel against jeopardising the stability of the region by getting involved. But I think it's quite notable that Israel sort of claimed responsibility for this. It's not the first strike they've carried out since the Syrian war broke out, but it is the first one they've said, yeah, that was us. So various other strikes have been aimed more at sort of stopping transfers of weapons from the government to Hezbollah. And I think that's yet more evidence for the idea that this is a sort of warning saying to just back off.
Shot across the bows, perhaps. I mean, it's worth remembering, of course, the countries are still, I guess, technically in a state of war, dating back to 1967.
Yeah. 1948.
Well, 48 indeed. Well, I mean, what prospect then do you think, Ben, that, you know, how much of a sort of area to watch is this? How concerned do you think Israel will be about specific issues relating to Golan Heights, given the instability?
Well, something that's interesting about the Golan Heights and where they sit in the Israeli mind is, in the 1990s, there were very, very serious negotiations and papers were arranged for a peace treaty in which Israel would return the Golan Heights to Syria and they would become a nature park. And only in 2006, you had very serious negotiations of returning the Golan Heights to Syria. And what this conflict means, I find it extremely hard to imagine that plateau being given back to Syria. Over the past 10 years in the Israeli mind, the West Bank, it ceased to be Jewish land in a way. It's become clear with the wall and kind of roadblocks. This is, we are here and they are there. And whatever it looks like, this will separate. But the Golan Heights, more people live there. And also every Israeli has been there and had a nice time there. So it's becoming cemented. And one of the casualties, I think, of the Syrian war for Syria will be the Golan Heights.
One of the many casualties. Intriguing insights there from Ben Jude. I want to turn for the last few minutes to, let's change the tempo, change the pace a little and talk a little bit about some campaigns. Let's go to the world of academia. It's by way of a break from all of this geopolitics. We've been seeing some campaigns by the likes of Harvard, Oxford and Cambridge getting in on the act. Students from ethnic minorities in those prestigious campuses holding a sort of board proclaiming various sort of demeaning phrases they're suggesting that they've heard during their studenthood, saying, you know, I too am Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge and so forth, to sort of draw a bit more attention quite directly to the kind of sort of everyday racism that people are actually still subjected to in the Ivy Leagues and as well as elsewhere around the world. Now, there's been some criticism that it could affect even more negatively the recruitment of students from all kinds of diverse backgrounds. Samira, I know you've written about this. Is it important that we have campaigns like this, people taking this kind of initiative, or does it risk getting the wrong sort of reaction? What do you think?
I think it's really important. I don't think I think it's misguided to think it risks it risks putting people off. I think that it's silly to think that these sorts of things happen only at Oxbridge or at Harvard or wherever. I mean, it happens all over the place. It happens all the time. But I think that it's always good to air those issues. And I think when you have institutions which are dominated by people from exclusive schools, from maybe cloistered backgrounds, that you will have some of these issues arise. And I think talking about it is not a bad thing. And I think it's quite a strange attitude to say, sort of just brush it under the carpet, don't talk about it, in case it puts people off, because that sort of does the opposite of addressing the root of the problem.
Do you think there is a complacency then? Is it perhaps rooted in the fact that we think, well, these are great bastions of learning, the great talented and intelligent students, people from all around the world? There can't be any of these kind of issues, surely. Is there a complacency collectively?
I'd say it's probably the opposite, actually, from within the institutions, that I think there is, I mean, having been to Oxford, as Ben did too, that there's a there's a real anxiety about the fact that it's seen as this elitist institution when actually it's, you know, there's so many misconceptions that like people think it costs more than other universities, it doesn't, all sorts of things, or you know, I won't fit in if I've been to a state school. All these things I think are untrue, and it's not, I don't think the message from the whiteboards was necessarily you're unwelcome here if you're from an ethnic minority, but it's still, so I think that there is that defensiveness that don't make us look bad to the outside world, don't put people off, like let's be inclusive, let's promote the positive. But I think promoting the positive shouldn't be done to a fault, shouldn't be done to the extent where you don't also address the negative.
What do you think briefly on this, Ben? I mean, Samira was mentioning that, you know, we have these shared experiences ourselves.
I didn't like Oxford. I thought it was an unpleasant, stuck-up institution with all kinds of low-level... I found it incredibly sexist, and I found that there is a low-level classism, racism...
So what, these issues you feel probably run deeper, and they need to be addressed.
Yeah, I think that they...
This kind of campaign, or is there something more radical?
I think this campaign is great, but I think the problem with Oxbridge is how the British elite is rigged, in which the people who go to Oxford, 50% of them or thereabouts, I'm not sure the exact figure, and they'll probably sue me if I give the wrong figure, come from 4 or 5 public schools, which you can only go to if your parents earn sort of £40,000 a year. And then you have the next 50%, which are kind of divvied up amongst grammar schools or state schools that have had cash injections or in rich neighbourhoods. And I did feel that there was a kind of, you know, it was a kind of very tokeny, ethnic minority presence was very tokeny there. I went to the French Lycée in London, so it was obviously part of the kind of multicultural wonders of London, and I was amazed.
Yeah, I was quite
Oxford.
Amazed at how white it was as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it was 90% white, and kind of, you know, having parents from different nationalities and speaking 2 languages at home and having this was weird.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Extraordinary. Well, perhaps the lesson there is there's certainly a campaign to welcome. Maybe it should go further, even. Those are the insights today of both Samira Shackle and Ben Judah, of course. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here today on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monocle 24 and this is Midori House. There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll be talking all things Norwegian with Lars Bavanger, and we'll learn about the race to build America's first subway with author Doug Most. But before we get started on all of that, let's hear from Bill Bingham, who's here with the latest world news headlines.
Pro-Russian activists have stormed Ukraine's naval base in the Crimean city of Sevastopol. Russian flags are now flying from the building and Ukrainian servicemen have been seen leaving it. There are unconfirmed reports that the head of Ukraine's navy has been detained. The United States and Europe are warning Russia its annexation of Crimea could harm its relations around the world for years to come. 2 women thought to be related to Chinese passengers on the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 have been removed from a press conference in Kuala Lumpur. Police have stopped the media from speaking to them. The authorities say they've received new radar data but are not yet in a position to make the details public. 26 countries are still involved in the search for the plane, which went missing 11 days ago with 239 people on board. A South African human rights lawyer says President Jacob Zuma has benefited unduly from using state money to make improvements to his rural residents. In a 400-page report, public protector Thuli Madonsela has accused Mr. Zuma of unethical conduct. Venezuela's government has announced that it's breaking commercial ties with Air Canada a day after the airline suspended flights to Caracas, citing the country's civil unrest. At least 29 people have been killed during about 6 weeks of protests and violent clashes between demonstrators and the security forces. The French rogue trader who caused huge losses at the Société Générale Bank has lost his appeal against a 3-year jail sentence. The Cour de Cassation, France's highest court, upheld the jail sentence against Jérôme Kerviel, but ordered a review of the €4.9 billion in damages he was told to pay. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. And there'll be more news, of course, from Bill Bingham at the top of the hour. He'll be back with a full bulletin for you at 1900 hours London time. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, it's time next to check in with one of our correspondents, located, as they are, all around the world. Today, well, we're talking about the latest Norwegian news, and we're joined, of course, by our expert, Lars Bavanger. Hello, Lars. Great to speak with you, as always. Welcome to Midori House. We start by talking about, food. Tell us about this. Food processed in Norway, shipped back to Norway and labelled as Norwegian. This is, sounds like a classic sort of food scandal. Is that how it's being interpreted there?
Well, it is a bit. It's the Norwegian state broadcaster NRK's top story today. So if you choose to buy a Norwegian cheese in Norway, which is heavily marketed as being Norwegian, you'd think it was made in Norway, right? But apparently not. They've found, NRK found a loophole in Norwegian import duty regulations, which allows food producers to send the raw product abroad to have it processed there, and then the finished product will be re-exported and imported back into Norway, if you like, without anyone having to pay any import duty for this. This is all because it's cheaper to do it this way, but of course consumers are a bit angry because you don't know where your Norwegian food has been made, and also environmentalists are a bit peeved off because, of course, this means that you're actually shipping food on a huge round trip, thousands of miles, when you actually don't need to.
It sounds like a bit of a scandal, Lars. And you mentioned that, I mean, consumers understandably feel cheated, environmentalists unhappy. What are the sort of particular problems with these duties? Why is it tariffs? Why on earth does this still make more sense? It seems an incredibly complex way to beat the system.
Well, normally there are quite high tariffs to import any kind of foodstuffs into Norway. And this is to protect Norwegian agriculture because Norwegian agriculture is very expensive to run. It's a tough country to be a farmer in, if you think about the nature with lots of mountains and pretty bad weather as well. So, but this idea that you should be able to send your Norwegian foodstuffs out of the country and then get it back in would be looked at as a win-win situation for both farmers in Norway who make the raw material, if you like, and for foreign food producers who then don't have to pay the export duty or import duty depending on where you are. And of course, they will also make money from actually manufacturing these products.
Indeed. Now, interestingly, that sounds like maybe Norway's not quite leading the way as it should be in that department. But in another field, talking about sort of automotive technology, electric cars, we often look to the Nordic nations, of course, as leaders in the field. But I gather maybe there are too many now in Norway. This can't be true, can it?
Well, funny you should say that. The Norwegian electric car market has completely exploded in recent years. And this is down to very generous government subsidies. You're allowed to use the bus lane. You don't have to pay road tax. You get free parking and charging even in many Norwegian city centres. And as a result, now, this week, new figures show that one in every 100 new cars sold in Norway are electric, which means, of course, that all those bus lanes are getting clogged up by electric cars, and there are no more parking space for electric cars in lots of the cities. So the Norwegian government is now looking into bringing forward an end to some of these subsidies, which were they were going to end in 2018, but they might have to end much, much sooner. So the Norwegian electric car market has been a victim of its own success, it will seem.
That is intriguing stuff, Lars. I just wonder, I guess politically, is that not going to be really damaging if this is proving very popular with the electorate, let's not forget, who are also these car owners? Is it a bit of a electoral suicide, or do you think that actually the government will be able to sell it just based on the fact that there are too many practical problems?
Well, the Norwegian car market is a little bit skewed in the first place because there are very, very heavy taxes on ordinary petrol and diesel cars. So buying, say, an ordinary Volkswagen Golf will set you back at least twice as much as you would pay for it back in the UK, whereas an electric car is not more expensive than a normal car. So given the choice, even without some of these subsidies, people will tend to opt for the cheaper electric electric car, well, maybe not cheaper to buy in the first place, but not more expensive anyway, and definitely cheaper to run than a petrol and diesel car. So I think the electric car has come to stay in Norway, but the rate at which they're selling or the increase in sales might start to taper off if some of these subsidies are withdrawn.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on that one. Let's talk a little bit about, well, not politics, I suppose, diplomacy more broadly. Always interesting to see who the big cheeses are, to go back to where we started at the start of this. The big cheese at NATO, though, I gather, Lars, might be a Norwegian character.
Yes, the former Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg, who was defeated in a general elections only last September, is now being touted as a very hot candidate. Apparently, he's got the backing of US President Barack Obama and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel as well. He's not confirmed or denied that he is a candidate, but he's said that if NATO countries do want him, he's definitely up for it. Of course, that would mean that the Norwegian Labour Party will have to elect a new leader, because he is still the opposition leader there. Now, critics say that it might be a little bit rich to have another Nordic NATO leader so soon or straight after the current General Secretary, who's, of course, Anders Fogh Rasmussen from Denmark. But it remains to be seen whether the 28 NATO countries will want a Norwegian in the hot seat.
Well, we'll have to watch that race very closely indeed. We'll probably come back to find out more, Lars, about what you think, depending on how the race shapes up. But for now, that's all from Lars Bavanger, our expert in all things Norway-related. Thanks very much for joining us on the programme. Up next on Midori House, we'll find out how America got its first subway system thanks to a sibling rivalry. Stay tuned to find out more right here on Midori House.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now it's to the US we go next. Boston has a long claim to be America's intellectual centre. New York prides itself on being the country's financial capital. So it's no surprise that the two cities were the ones involved in a race to build the country's first subway. More intriguingly, however, is the idea that two brothers were at the centre of the competition, Henry Whitney and his brother William in New York. In the race underground, Boston, New York, and the incredible rivalry that built America's first subway, the journalist and author Doug Most chronicles the story of the US's first underground system and explains how the brothers managed to get past their sibling rivalry, and that is not easy, to collaborate on transport ventures. I'm delighted to say Doug joins me on the line now, live from Boston, appropriately enough. Doug, welcome to the programme. Great to have you with us. Now, tell me, it's kind of an unlikely starting place to head underground in this way. What was it about this story of tunnels and rivalry that so enthralled you from the beginning?
Well, it was really a story about American history, and not just American history, but really world history. I mean, this was the second half of the 19th century, the late 1800s, were just an incredible time of innovation and change in the world. At the beginning of that 50-year period, in 1863, London opened the world's first subway. It was a remarkable achievement. It was sort of dug through clay, and it was just an amazing feat by some engineers and by the workers who sort of risked life and limb to build this tunnel. It was an amazing feat, and that one of the things that struck me as interesting as I was looking at that project is that I was curious why it was almost another 30 years before the next subway around the world opened. You know, so you would think that when London opened its subway, you would almost think that that would pave the way for other cities to sort of immediately, you know, jump on the bandwagon, so to speak. But in fact, it didn't happen that way. It was another 30, 35 years before Boston and New York would open their subways, would be the second and third and the first in this country. And that was really interesting why that was.
Tell us a little bit then about the characters that made that happen. As you said, there's this long hiatus. I'm sure people probably globally were anticipating other initiatives like that sooner. It always seems to take, though, these extraordinary characters to actually galvanise people and make it happen. I mean, what was it about the Whitney family? As you were sort of researching the book and studying the history, were there any clues as to the fact that they were men who would end up doing this kind of breakthrough?
Well, they were such fascinating men because they were very different. So Henry Whitney, they came from a family of a long history of Whitneys in this country. They came over in the 1600s. And Henry Whitney was sort of the slacker of the two brothers. He was sort of the one who struggled, dropped out of school, was short and stocky with a mustache, and struggled to find a direction in life. His brother was the opposite. His brother went to Harvard and went to Yale and became a very successful lawyer, married into one of the wealthiest families in this country, the Payne family, which had made a fortune in the oil industry, and became hugely successful in politics, and in fact could have been president of the United States if he wanted to be. So these two brothers sort of came from very different backgrounds and were two very different men, but the one thing they had in common was this drive and this motivation to be very successful businessmen. And they did achieve that, but through very different ways. And both of them, what happened was both of them got involved in the transit systems in their two cities. Henry Whitney lived in Boston, his brother William moved to New York, and they became deeply immersed in the transit systems, the street transit systems at the time in their cities. And that would eventually pave the way to them getting more involved in subways.
So that's the kind of cast of the family. But the book is peopled with an extraordinary cast of players, isn't it? Names everyone around the globe from all different disciplines will be familiar with, and presidents and Thomas Edison, of course. It really did take a cabal of exceptional people to make this happen. It must have been fun, though, to bring all of those threads together, you know, work in the influences of people like Edison on these projects and bind it all together into the book.
It really was. I mean, you know, there were so many sort of great moments in the book that I found personally fascinating. One of the key characters in the book is a gentleman named Frank Sprague. So if we think of Thomas Edison perhaps as the world's greatest inventor and a man who sort of just changed the way our lives lived. Well, there was another inventor by the name of Frank Sprague who lived around the same time, but sadly sort of did his work in the shadow of Edison. He actually worked for Thomas Edison for about a year. Whereas Edison was focused on the light, Frank Sprague was determined to develop the electric motor. The electric motor was something that was critical to the development of subways ultimately. When London opened its subway in 1863, it was, and this is sort of hard to believe today, a steam train underground. So the next time we all want to complain about how dirty it is riding on a subway, we should imagine what it must have been like when that was a steam train coming through those tunnels.
So some people would say, Doug, that it hasn't changed that much up to the present day, but that I think that would be rather unfair. But it's amazing that they realized the importance early on of perfecting that electric technology, though.
Yeah, and so that was a critical development. Frank Sprague developed the electric motor, perfected the electric motor, and that was a critical step towards cities then saying, okay, we can build a subway, and it doesn't have to be a steam train underground. It can be one that's powered by electricity. And Frank Sprague developed that sort of in the shadow of Thomas Edison and never quite got the appreciation and recognition he probably deserved, because you could argue that the electric motor changed the way we lived as much as anything.
Let me just ask you, Doug, finally, in terms of how you'd sort of define the book, it's interesting that you said to me it's a kind of a history. I know a lot of the critics say it's, you know, a history of cities as well as a history of these great men and these great minds. How do you define the book? Is it a history of Boston and New York? It does at times read, understandably, of course, like a bit of a love letter to one or both of them. Is it a social history? How do you sort of categorize it?
It's a good question. I obviously Boston and New York are at the center of it, but there are several chapters in the book and several themes to the book that I think speak to a much broader audience. As someone said, it sort of is a love poem to the way we move about, and that's true, because one of the things in the book that I was really sort of interested in is exploring the idea that when we go down underground today, all of us, we walk down those stairs or we take an elevator underground, we stare at our smartphones, we stare at our papers, we sort of just do it very cavalierly and very casually. We don't think twice about it. But the fact is that centuries ago, the idea of going underground to mankind in general was terrifying. It was frightening. Man would not go down there. That was where the devil lived. That was where bodies were buried. That was the worst place we would ever go. And the book explores how mankind had to overcome that fear of the underground in order to embrace the underground and embrace the idea not just of going down there, but of traveling underground. That was a critical, critical moment for us. And the London subway and then eventually the Boston and New York subways helped that happen.
Doug Most, Deputy Managing Editor of the Boston Globe and the author of The Race Underground, Boston, New York, and the Incredible Rivalry That Built America's First Subway, proving, I think, eloquently there that sometimes the deeper you go underground, the more illuminating things can be. Doug, thanks very much for joining us here on the programme. Talking with Doug there about America's subways and their history, let's stay below ground level. This is the Velvet Underground and Sunday Morning. That was the Velvet Underground with Sunday Morning here on Midori House, reflecting our underground theme after our chat with Doug Most a little earlier. Now we're ticking towards the end of the programme, but not before. Our weekly review of the very best international shows in a whole variety of different arts arenas. Today we're discussing dance and ballet with Louise Levine, novelist and ballet columnist for The Telegraph. Louise, thanks for joining us. Great to have you joining us on Midori House. Welcome to the studio. Where shall we begin? Shall we start with a bit of Sleeping Beauty, perhaps?
A little bit of Sleeping Beauty. There's a lot on this week, but it is a week kind of dominated by revivals. You know, some week there's a lot of new work. Sometimes it's good old stuff. And the Royal Ballet's Sleeping Beauty, which this production was originally danced just after the war, made with scraps of this and that, turned into the most sumptuous production by Oliver Messel in 1946 and stayed in the rep and for many years afterwards. But eventually they had to replace it. And then in 2006, they loved it so much they wanted it back. And so it was revived. Now, if you get your skates on this minute, you can go and see it pretty much anywhere in the world because it's one of those lovely live relays to cinemas. Now, I used to form a crucifix and fight off the idea of watching dance on screen.
But what do you think about that? It does sort of open things up a little, doesn't
it? I think it's tremendous. I mean, not only is it fundamentally really democratic, it makes something which people claim is elite totally accessible to everyone, but it's really high-quality stuff. You know, it is not a long shot and a bit of panning and scanning. There's something really very sophisticated going on in the camera work these days.
And I don't mean... brings the performance to you wherever you happen to be.
Absolutely. I don't mean sophisticated in the sense of tricksy either. I mean that the director, Ross McGibbon, knows where you want to look. Mm. You know, which from someone who, you know, sees quite a lot of Sleeping Beauties, you know, through my little opera glasses, checking out what I want to see. To have the camera picking those shots can be very frustrating. But not now. You know, they really know where you want to look and you suddenly find the whole ballet illuminated in the most tremendous detail. Now, this can be good news if you're a great dancer with lots of detail to communicate, or it can be bad news if you actually are quite inexpressive and best seen from the gods. In the case of tonight's cast, and as I say, it starts 7:30 London time, you could get there an hour later because the stars aren't on for an hour, and you'll see Stephen McRae, recently voted Young Australian of the Year, who is just non-stop star, and Sarah Lamb, an American ballerina, giving the most tremendous performance. So hugely exciting, Tchaikovsky as well. And as I say, these great big screens, it's thrilling in a totally different way from the live performance. It really is quite thrilling.
And just briefly, in terms of the sort of the evolution of this performance, so there's sort of elements of that well-known and well-loved production. How's the sort of, how does it change? Will connoisseurs recognise sort of elements of that, some of that heritage in that?
Oh, yes. I mean, the steps are very largely the pas steps from 1890. So that side of it is absolutely, you know, boilerplated and solid. 1946, the beautiful kind of disappearing vistas of staircases and skies and curtains and the kind of imperial Louis XIV kind of qualities of the original Oliver Messel designs are all absolutely as per. They originally, when they revived it in 2006, thought, oh, the costumes were a bit gaudy, weren't they? And they had some rather pallid costumes on the idea that shouldn't the costumes kind of go with the sets? Well, no, actually, this isn't a showbiz party. We're not dressing to match the decor. And little by little, all those vivid velvets have come back. So it is
wonderful,
you know,
stuff. The clock is against Louis, so let's race on to the next one. Where should we go?
Let's go to Oxford, where Rombert, they're now called Rombert. They were Rombert Dance Company. They began life in 1926 as Ballet Rombert, are doing a mixed bill, which has some new work in it, which is great. But the bill which they're touring is built around another revival, this time Rooster, which sounds like it should be hell. It was done in 1991 by Christopher Bruce, set to Rolling Stones records. You'd think that was going to be a bit sort of, you know, TV dancers, oh dear, oh dear. And in fact, not. It isn't ghastly. It is the 60s sex war in miniature, done through gesture, through a little bit of social dance. And it's great. It's characterful, but it's contemporary, which perfectly suits Rombert's kind of whole mindset. That's terrific. I have to go in a second because we've got Kings of the Dance on in London as well, which is kind of international sort of three tenors of the dance thing with boys, big beasts from all the royal, all the ballet companies around the world, from the Mikhailovsky, the Mariinsky, American Ballet Theatre, La Scala. And they're all joining forces in a kind of second-rate programme. You know, they've got a specially recorded score, which basically is code for no orchestra. But Ivan Vassiliev is going to be dancing another piece from 1946, Le Jeune Homme et l'Amour. And if I don't go, I'm going to be late.
Wonderful stuff. Well, Louise Levine, we can't possibly stand in your way. Thanks so much for putting us in the frame of some of those great shows to catch. Time is money for people. They must hurry to see your recommendations. That's all we have time for in today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to my special guests in studio, Ben Judah and Samira Shackle, and of course Louise Levine here as well. Today's show is produced by Daphne Denis, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow with another edition of Midori House. Until then, have a very good evening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.